you're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snow blankets much of the north today, as we've heard, and we're looking at one of the primary ways to deal with slippery roads and sidewalks. One word, salt. More than 500,000 tons of it was poured onto our roads in Wisconsin last winter, trying to balance, though, the need for safe roads versus the risk of damaging our lakes. So what questions do you have about road salt? How do you decide how much to use on your driveway, on your sidewalks or parking lots? Have you ever tried an alternative like brine or sand? We're at 800-642-1234. Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology, and she's studied lakes in Wisconsin and both poles for good measure, the Arctic and Antarctica. Hillary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So you recently went to a transportation department meeting about road salt. How is Wisconsin looking to change the way salt is applied, on these icy roads?
Yeah, it's been really interesting as an ecologist who studies sort of the tail end of where salt ends up. It's been eye-opening to work with the Department of Transportation and see how they're changing management practices. They're both concerned about, the economic cost of road salt, as well as the environmental impact and the impact on our infrastructure. And so they've been trying to switch their practices more towards liquid brine application. And so during the storm, you might see a little bit more brine on the roads than traditional road salt. And that's proven really effective in reducing usage through really just using less.
So what is exactly brine? What goes into it?
Yeah, so it's just taking traditional rock salt and mixing it with water into a salty, sort of a salty liquid, much like ocean water, except saltier. And it's sprayed on the road as opposed to rock salt being kind of distributed onto the road. And the problem with rock salt is a lot of it would just bounce off. It'd hit the road, the trucks are driving quickly, your car will drive past, and the rock salt ends up in the ditch where it's not being effective in helping public safety. It just is effective in polluting our fresh water. And so brine's been a good switch because it's sprayed on the road, and so it tends to stick to the surface. And you can get a lot more coverage with
good,
less salt.
Better coating, I
yeah,
imagine.
A better coating. And you can put it down before the storm, too. And so often you'll see these brine lines on the road. And so the brine's there when the snowstorm starts. It starts working right away.
It would seem the brine would be a more diluted concentration as well of, compared to, traditional chunky road salt.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. The chunky road salt was just really, you could have really high concentrations if there was a lot of salt put down and concentrations at which you were just sort of wasting salt. And other times, if you didn't have enough salt, you might have really low concentrations that weren't proven effective. And so the brine kind of ensures a more consistent coverage. And it's easier to apply once you have the right infrastructure to do that.
Is it less expensive than the chunky salt?
It ends up being less expensive because you use a lot less salt. And so what counties have seen that are switching towards liquid application is they save so much money on purchasing salt that it pays for all of that infrastructure within the first year. So a huge economic savings for these counties that have switched to it. And at a state level, if we can reduce our use by 50%, which is what some of these counties are seeing, we're talking tens of millions of dollars of savings in purchasing salt.
Well, when you say what infrastructure is happening here by the savings, how much does it cost to convert a salt truck into a brine truck?
Yeah, so initially, I think a lot of the problem with the conversion was no one really knew how to do it because it was brand new. And so you have a salt truck. How do you convert it to a brine truck, or how do you build a sprayer? And so a lot of work went into just the research and development of that. But the DOT's figured that out, and there's a lot of knowledge transfer both between counties and with municipalities. And there's been a lot of investment in brine production, so facilities to produce brine. And once you have that and trucks that can carry brine and spray it, you can get up and running really quickly.
So you're seeing conversion more seamless now between the older technology of the rock salt and trying out the new brine system?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it took a while to get up and going, but once people figured out how to implement it and then actually have seen the savings, it's sort of a no-brainer that that's going to be the future of de-icing.
We're talking about road salt with Hillary Dugan from UW-Madison Center for Limnology. What questions do you have about salting roads and driveways or sidewalks? Are you a commuter? Have you noticed better road conditions in counties that use more brine? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Hillary, in Wisconsin, who decides how much salt or brine gets used on, you know, city, county, or state roads?
So that's a good question. I think it's changed a lot over the years. I mean, in the end, it comes down to whoever's driving the truck. But there is guidance at the state level that goes down to counties, that goes down to managers, that goes down to drivers. And really trying to dial that into a specific number of, you know, how many pounds per lane mile you use really depends on the weather. And so some of that's left up to the driver. But we've gotten a lot better at calibrating our machines and tracking how much salt we use. So as opposed to back in the day where, you know, you'd fill up your truck with salt and you wanted to come back empty, you know, more realization now that you really want to use only as much as you have to use. And if that truck comes back full of salt, that's great.
Let's go to Marcus now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What's your question?
Good morning. So I'm wondering how much is being lost for potential material to create friction, because with the rock salt, you actually have like chunks in the road to create some extra friction between tires and, you know, what might be a slippery road where, if I understand it correctly, the brine kind of goes into those grooves or whatever. Is there an application where both should be used?
Great question.
That is a great question. And I think using salt for friction is part of the problem of why we use too much salt. We should really be using sand or, you know, small gravel for friction, because it's not going to, I mean, it's not going to dissolve in the way salt will. So the point of using rock salt is it's supposed to dissolve into brine, which then melts snow. And so its purpose isn't for friction in the first place, but people end up using it for friction, which is part of the environmental problem. Instead, a lot of applicators will use a sand salt mixture. So you use some salt for melting efficacy, and then you use sand for that traction.
Yeah, where are we at with gravel and sand? How is it used? Is it just used as a complement, or sometimes can we just all out use the sand?
Yeah, I mean, you'll see a lot of sand applied, especially on municipal roads where you're not having high speed traffic. And so some cities have rules where they're only going to salt the major arterials and just sand sort of the side roads, you know, saying that we're going to plow them and sand them and there'll be enough traction to drive slowly. And so there's a lot of sand use in the state for sure.
How does sand impact our lake ecosystems?
So Wisconsin's pretty naturally sandy. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of sand naturally. And so we haven't seen too big of an environmental impact overall of sand use. That's not the case everywhere. There's some pristine lakes, especially in the West. I mean, Lake Tahoe is a good example where, you know, they have sand problems because it's not naturally sandy and they've added a lot of sand. And so there's places where that's a problem. That's not really the case in Wisconsin yet.
What about the brine and salt? What is the impact there on our lakes?
So the problem is that we have fresh water in Wisconsin. We have a lot of it, and everything that lives in it is adapted to living in fresh water. And so as we start increasing the salinity concentration of that water, we start seeing ecosystems that are stressed, and it also impacts our drinking water. So if we're getting drinking water from rivers or lakes or even shallow groundwater, we're starting to see higher salt concentrations in that, which has human health implications.
We're talking about the evolving science of fighting ice on our roads with Hillary Dugan from UW-Madison. Do you think the state is using too much salt on sidewalks and roads? Are there highways that you think need more salt? Have you seen salt eat away at your car or perhaps your shoes? Join in with your questions, your situation, your stories, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with Hillary Dugan in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about road salt here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the average cost of road salt climbing, government agencies have experimented with brine, this watery salt mixture. And agencies dumped more than 5 million gallons of brine on our highways and streets last winter. That's according to the State Transportation Department. It's not even counting the amount of brine used by private companies or residents. So what questions do you have about brine or alternatives to chunky road salt? Have you tried using sand instead? Did it work for you or not really? What outcomes have you had? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Tina is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Tina.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good.
I have a few comments. Number one, I think there's a reason that we're called the Rust Belt, and that because car manufacturing was here and rust was designed to make sure that we would keep buying cars. Number two, I lived in the Pacific Northwest for over 30 years, and they used primarily salt, and we're talking about elevations of 6,000 feet and mountain driving. And there was never a reason to use salt out there. Number three is the pollution that's happening to our lakes, and it's not slowing people down, the salt. And I think we should stop using it altogether because the roads and the potholes are all contributed to the salt that we're doing. The ecosystem is affected by the salt that we're putting into our lake, and we are just destroying it. After how many years that we have been using salt, it is not as effective as it should be, and it's ruining our environment.
Tina, thank you so much for the call. Is it possible to go salt-free?
I think it's possible to go salt-free in certain areas. We definitely use too much salt, especially when we think about places where we're not really driving quickly. I mean, we put piles of salt down in parking lots where, you know, there's very little traffic and people are driving slowly, and so we really need to rethink, you know, where we're using salt and why we're using it. You know, there's sort of two ends of the spectrum. What we're doing now, which is using over 500,000 tons of salt per year and have been for decades. And the other end of the spectrum is no salt. And so right now I think it's trying to find that happy medium where we maintain de-icing on, you know, major arterials and sort of bring the level of salting down on places where we don't need it. Tina brought up an interesting point about the Northwest not using salt, and you know, that's true, and they have a very different climate out west where it's drier. A lot of the snow evaporates pretty quickly. Sometimes it's colder and salt's not effective. As you go further north, people don't salt either because it's too cold for it to be effective. So we really live in this perfect climate zone where we do have a lot of icy conditions right below freezing. And so because salt's been so effective in our Wisconsin climate, we've used a lot of it. And we've come to expect the state to use a lot of it. So we expect when we go to the store that the parking lot will be salted and we can just wear, you know, our sneakers in the winter and walk across a dry parking lot. But maybe we have to change our expectations of living in a wintry state.
When you study the lakes, do you see after winter salt concentrations going down? How do our lake ecosystems absorb this salt?
Yeah, so what we need to remember is that every ounce of salt we put on the ground or use is going to end up in our water. Even though the salt we put in our water softeners is going to the sewage district and it's going to end up being flushed into a river. So every ounce of salt that we purchase ends up in the environment, whether that's lakes or rivers or groundwater. And so we see different trends in different areas, but in urban systems, we definitely see huge pulses of salt in the winter and in the spring during snowmelt, concentrations that are, you know, definitely not fresh water anymore.
What is that doing to our freshwater lakes and the whole, you know, all the fish?
Yeah, so it different species respond differently to salt concentrations. There's lots of evidence that certain amphibians and smaller species are affected at really low concentrations. What we have to remember, too, is that everything that's native to Wisconsin is adapted to freshwater. And so as we increase the salinity of our lakes and rivers, all we're doing is making these ecosystems more tolerant for invasive species. So, you know, we hear a lot about invasive species like zebra mussels. They come from a brackish environment in Europe. They don't care about the salt concentrations. And so if we're concerned about some of these invasive species taking over our rivers and lakes, adding salt to them is only helping them survive.
We're discussing road salt with Hillary Dugan from UW-Madison Center for Limnology. What questions do you have about salting roads, driveways, or sidewalks? We're at 800-642-1234. Frank called in to ask, how does calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, potassium chloride affect the environment, and which is best to use on driveways?
So all of those compounds are salts, and they all have chloride in them. And so in the end, they're all adding chloride to the environment. So they're having the same impact on our water. They're different in terms of their how effective they are. So magnesium chloride and potassium chloride are more effective at lower temperatures. They're also cost more. And there's also evidence that they're worse on infrastructure in terms of rusting. And so for the most part, people tend to stick to sodium chloride because it's cheap and because it's not quite as hard on infrastructure, although it is quite hard. But in certain cases where the temperatures are low enough and you still have ice, you'll see people use calcium and potassium chloride.
Is brine even tough on cars and shoes?
Yeah,
and
I mean,
that?
It's going to be tough in the same way that traditional rock salt is. So traditional rock salt, the way it works is when it snows, the water from the snow dissolves the salt. And so it ends up being a brine. In this case, we're just applying it as a brine mixture first. So either way, you end up with brine, and it's gonna rust your car.
We'll arrive at the same location.
Yeah.
Let's go to Josh now in Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. Yeah, I've been doing the automotive industry for 22 years, and yeah, there's always salt on the cars and everything, and the guys are always getting dripped on. But this new brine salt that came out a little while ago, that stuff, when it actually hits your skin coming off the cars, it actually leaves red marks and it burns. And you definitely don't want to get in your eyes. So I'd really love to know how that is happening and why. And, you know, what is it doing to the cars or anything else out in the environment, if that's the case? Because
sounds pretty toxic there. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a great answer for that, Josh. It's usually the brine that the counties are using is sort of traditional rock salt, just mixed with water to a concentration of 23%. So I'm not sure why it would be different from sort of salt brine that was made that ended up dissolving from traditional rock salt in terms of its how corrosive it would be to your skin. But obviously it's quite salty, and maybe there's other places that are using
or it
different
could be
formula.
Mixing with other chemicals that are on the body of the car and engine in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about roads and automobiles, there's a lot of different chemicals floating around.
Yeah, let's go to Andy now in Madison. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind about rock salt?
Well, years ago, when they first talked about liquid de-icing applications, there was a lot of talk about, I believe it was a beet sugar being in there instead of brine. And I was curious if that's ever come to happen.
Yeah, so you do see beet sugar being used. It's used because of it. It's because it's sticky. It actually helps salt adhere to the road, so it prevents that problem of sort of the salt just bouncing off the road into the ditch. The problem with beet sugar and any other kind of
What is beet sugar?
So, from beets, from the
beet,
vegetable
beet
okay. sugar,
beet sugar. carry on.
Yeah. So it's the problem with adding any sort of organic substance to the roads is that that beet sugar actually just acts as food for microbes and creates other water quality problems. So on a small scale, the use of beet sugar is fine. But if it was something that we were to use en masse across the entire state, we would see water quality problems stemming from that as well.
Andy, thanks so much for the call. Michael from Madison couldn't stay with us but wants to know if Wisconsin has considered the liquid mixture that thaws aircrafts and runways at airports instead of salt, that de-icing agent.
So that de-icing agent is very effective, but also contains a lot of pollutants in it. There's a lot of chemicals in there that you wouldn't want to just add to your roads and have that run off into your storm sewers. So airports have pretty elaborate ways of capturing that de-icing agent. I mean, it's regulated by the EPA. They can't let that get into the environment.
And when they're spraying it on the wings, that's mm-hmm. that they're spraying it at a really high pressure.
They are, and they're when you would notice if you're on a plane is that that plane will actually go over to a de-icing pad to be de-iced. And then they have to go to that specific pad because underneath that pad there's infrastructure to capture the de-icing agent because you just wouldn't want those pollutants released into the environment.
So where does this leave us? What should we be thinking as we approach winter with salt and brine and sand and all the other products out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should rethink how much salt we're using. And so as, you know, the average citizen, think about, you know, if you use salt on your driveway and sidewalk, think about if you need to, think about how much you're using. You know, the recommended amount you should apply to a driveway is about one cup of salt, which is actually very little. If you're applying more than that, it stops being effective. And so most people use too much salt if they're using salt. You know, we encourage people to get out there and shovel. It's hard sometimes, and I realize that, you know, salt is necessary at some point. But think about, you know, the stores you visit, and if their parking lot's full of salt, you know, maybe talk to the owner about their contractor and just try to, you know, generally spread the word that, you know, we're oversalting and there's a lot of steps we can take to easily bring down that total usage while still maintaining public safety.
Hillary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology, and we've been talking about the science behind applying salt and brine to icy roads. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about holiday gatherings when a loved one is coping with dementia. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this can be a difficult time. Family traditions may be different than they once were, and hosting a guest with dementia may require you to do some adjustments to your own environment. But just because a loved one has dementia doesn't mean that their desire to connect and enjoy the holidays goes away. So caregivers, how do you approach this time? How do you manage your own stress and the expectations of other family members? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Art Walasek is a psychiatry professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's a member of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Dr. Walasek, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, and thanks for talking about this really important topic.
Well, here it is, a time when we have these holiday parties, we have these social family gatherings all at the same table. How might someone with dementia experience these events differently than people without memory decline?
Yeah, great question. And I think, I think it's very important to include folks with dementia in these gatherings. I mean, they have incredible value as a ritual, as a celebration, as a chance for family to get together and share stories and form new memories and so on. So it's important to engage folks with dementia. However, it can be a different or challenging experience for them. So, you know, one thing that comes to mind is just the duration of one of these events. You know, I think we've all been in holiday gatherings that maybe have gone on too long. Someone with dementia may have difficulty with that. Dementia is a neurologic illness that causes fatigue, and so you kind of tire early and may not be able to make it quite as long. Time of day could be a challenge as well. So some people with dementia have kind of rough patches over the course of the day. So like late afternoon, early evening is often a difficult time. That's a time when a lot of these celebrations, of course, are taking place. And so one potential adjustment or accommodation could be thinking about having holiday plans earlier in the day, you know, late brunch, early lunch, something like that, something that may be a little easier for a person with dementia to tolerate.
Someone in earlier stages might be more quiet, more withdrawn from conversation. Why is that?
Yeah, great question. So I think one of the things that could arise is that it can be a little overwhelming or overstimulating. So you think about a holiday party. It's noisy. There are lots of people. There are people you haven't seen in a long time. Maybe you don't quite recognize who they are. There's lots of blinking lights and candles and, you know, all kinds of distractions going on. And that can be overwhelming. And so one potential response to that is to try to sort of pull yourself out of that, withdraw a little bit, kind of tone in the amount of input that you're getting. And in fact, it sort of raises an interesting idea that for a person with dementia, to make it a better experience for them, kind of thinking about having a separate space for them at the gathering. So maybe like a quiet room that they can go to and relax if they're getting overstimulated, or other family members can come and visit them there, and so on. So it could also be, you know, people get quiet if they're worried they're going to say the wrong thing, or if they don't remember someone's name, like that might be very embarrassing, and so they'd rather not say anything at all. So that could be a potential issue as well in terms of why is someone getting quiet.
And, you know, drawing them out would be one thing, but there can also be a situation where a loved one with dementia is telling the same story over and over. How do you deal with that situation?
Yeah, so that gets into kind of the interesting domain of like, well, how much do you prep other people for, well, you know, my dad has developed dementia now. He's going to be behaving a little bit differently over the course of this meal. How much do you divulge of that to family and guests of at the party? You know, a lot can happen over the course of a year or two with someone with dementia. And, you know, the nature of a lot of these gatherings is that people may not have seen each other for that time. And so they may look quite different. And so I think it'd be worthwhile to think ahead of time, well, maybe I'm just going to let people know a little bit that, you know, things have changed. Dad may tell the same story over again, or maybe he'll get upset or quiet, but, you know, that's nothing personal. It's not intentional. It's just part of his illness right now.
Keep giving people a heads up earlier on if they haven't seen that person in a year or maybe longer.
Exactly, exactly.
We're talking with Dr. Art Walasek. He's a geriatric psychiatrist at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about family gatherings and traditions as family members are supportive of a loved one with dementia. Have you changed your holiday traditions or come up with new ones that are more inclusive of your relative with memory decline? How do you talk to other family members who may not be in regular contact with the relative who has memory loss? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. This can be a very stressful time, regardless of whether you are a caregiver or not. How can caregivers set realistic expectations for themselves, for the environment, for other people who will be at this important family gathering?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, I think caregiving is an incredibly difficult job to begin with. It's often a 24/7 job. People are stressed out caring for their loved one with dementia. And then you add on top of that, 20 people are going to be at my house and I have to prepare a meal and so-and-so is flying in from some, you know, et cetera. It's a lot of stress. So I think part of managing that can be just setting different expectations. We're going to have fewer people this year, or not as quite elaborate of a meal this year, or it's going to be a shorter duration, or we're going to do it at someone else's house so that they can do the cleanup after, you know, et cetera. So there may just need to be some changes to these traditions so that they are, in fact, more manageable. And hopefully the person who's the primary caregiver for the person with dementia isn't also the person who's putting on all the different festivities. Maybe there are other relatives or friends who can come and help out with those things. Because ultimately, you want this to be a fun, joyous experience, not, you know, yet another burden on top of all the other burdens.
And it was interesting, too, to think about scale in the situation and how to adapt and still share bonds and memories. I mean, there was this one example of, well, our family's always gone to the Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. Well, instead of going out to the Nutcracker with this family member who has dementia, we're going to watch it at home in the family room and, you know, have a quieter moment like this where we can still carry on this tradition in a different way.
It's such a great adaptation. I mean, that's so much of what caregiving is about. It's adjusting to these ever-changing circumstances and needing to have this almost jazz-like fluid response to situations. So that's a lovely example of taking a tradition and continuing in a different way. It also calls to mind that, you know, people with dementia have, you know, maintained significant strengths like long-term memories or musical abilities. So musical abilities fade much later in dementia than verbal abilities. So people can still sing. They may remember songs from their teens and 20s very, very well and be able to carry on a tune and maybe even dance. And, you know, they can participate in a lot of these activities. So they could actually be a real kind of strength and resource for the family in that way.
And you see that, too, at memory care centers where music is so much in part of that caregiving that that also might be a very familiar thing as well.
Absolutely. And also, things like family photo albums. So in dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, short-term, more recent memories typically have faded and are difficult to retrieve, but longer-term memories stick around for quite a while. And so those folks may actually have pretty good recall of, you know, something that happened many, many years ago or who so-and-so was in the photo and so on. So again, that may really play to their strengths.
What about traveling with a relative who has dementia, taking them in a car from point A to point B?
Yeah, so travel, well, we heard the weather report just a bit ago. I mean, travel during the holidays is challenging to begin with. So I think that requires a lot of kind of planning ahead. What's really going to be realistic? How long, if you're doing it by car, how long of a car ride is going to be realistic? What, you know, we haven't talked at all about some of the physical changes that go along with aging and dementia, like urinary problems and, you know, and so on. And so that can become a significant stressor when driving too. So, you know, I would say planning ahead, pacing yourself, not expecting that you're going to get, you know, many hundreds of miles very quickly, because it could be a slower journey to get there and to get back.
And the confusion as well. Should you keep reminding the loved one where we're going and why?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, some of the tips, and by the way, there are some really great resources out there. So the NIA, the National Institute on Aging, has some wonderful resources on holidays for the caregivers. The Alzheimer's Association mm-hmm. does as well. My colleague Alexis Eastman, who's a geriatrician at UW, had a wonderful podcast episode last year on this topic. So there are a lot of great resources out there for folks. So I think lots of good potential places for people to go to get more information about this as well.
When it is no longer possible for the relative with dementia to participate in family traditions, how do you broach that? What do you do?
Well, I think, I think it's that question of adaptation. You know, is there something that can still be done? I mean, for example, let's say a person has fairly advanced dementia and is in a memory care unit. So often memory care units will have some sort of holiday celebration. And so bringing family to the person with dementia and having a probably, you know, brief but hopefully touching, moving, poignant kind of time with the person. So, some of the regular traditions around eating and having everyone in your home and so on may need to change in that context. But again, really, I think it's really important to consider including that person. They're still there. They're still a member of the family and really should be engaged to the extent that's possible.
We're talking about the holiday season when a loved one has dementia. Dr. Art Walasek is a psychiatry professor at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Have you come up with a new tradition that a loved one with dementia really appreciated? What was it? How are you doing at this time? Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with geriatric psychiatrist Art Walasek here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're having a conversation about family gatherings and making them more inclusive for loved ones with dementia. There are different types of dementia, with Alzheimer's disease among the most common. More than 5 million older adults live with Alzheimer's in our country, and caring for patients with memory loss takes a toll on families, especially this time of year. So how do you talk with other family members who may not be in regular contact with the relative who has dementia? What advice do you have for fellow caregivers? What have you found that works, that makes an easier time during the holidays? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Psychiatrist Art Walasek stays with us, and his most recent book is on the behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. Dr. Walasek, let's look at a couple of scenarios here. If a relative with dementia confuses you with someone else and is asking you to remember things that you weren't around for, what is the best way to respond to that situation?
What a great question. So that's something that comes up because as people lose memory, they start to kind of confuse generations. And so they may think that someone who's in fact their spouse is their parent, or someone who's their child is their sibling or their spouse. And this can make for some very awkward encounters. And so I think this is where we were talking earlier about how much do you prep the family. I think that's a thing that you can say. You know, if you've seen that your loved one with dementia has been doing this, has been having some generational confusion, just warning people about that ahead of time. And, you know, a lot of this is just kind of, you know, rolling with it, trying to respond in a non-defensive, kind of understanding way, and maybe shifting the conversation to a different topic. Like, oh, you're confusing me with so-and-so. Let's talk about so-and-so, and what do you remember about them, and so on. So, you know, it takes a little bit of skill and practice, but that can be a way to kind of respond to that. And again, hopefully not get offended or view that as insulting or, you know, or something like that. Really, the person doesn't mean it. That's just a mistake that they've made.
Let's talk about food and drink at the holidays. When you are bringing in a guest who has dementia, what should you be thinking along those lines?
Yeah, so, you know, on the food side of things, you want to think some about maybe the richness of the meal. The person may have had a fairly bland diet recently, and so overwhelming them with tons of really rich food may not be a great idea. There could be issues around chewing and choking hazards and things like that. Alcohol is sort of a complicated, tricky issue in this context. So alcohol is an important part of many holiday celebrations. It's part of tradition for many folks. But alcohol's problematic in someone with dementia. So alcohol affects memory. It affects balance. It affects judgment and, you know, impulse control. And those are all things that a person with dementia could be struggling with. And so alcohol could just make those things worse. And so, you know, ideally, not having any alcohol for the person with dementia would probably be best, but if they need to have some as part of a ritual, just the smallest amount possible, or diluting it down, or something so that they can engage in that act, that ritual, but without getting some of the negative effects of alcohol.
I could imagine it could also interact with their meds.
Oh, that's a great taking. Oh, absolutely. What a great point. Sure, they're often on medications that themselves affect balance and affect concentration and things like that, and then alcohol just adds on top of that.
What about holiday gift giving? Is there anything that should be avoided, or how do you approach gift giving with someone with dementia?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think you know, things that are going to be overly complicated or potentially even, you know, dangerous would be things to avoid. It actually raises an interesting issue around just other, like, safety issues around the house as well. So, like, if you're having a bunch of people over, including someone with dementia, and there are, you know, open flames like candles or tripping hazards or loose rugs or things like that, those could all potentially be, you know, significant safety issues for the person with dementia as well.
We're talking with geriatric psychiatrist Art Walasek about family gatherings and how to make them more inclusive of loved ones who are coping with dementia. Still time for your stories, your situation, and your ideas on how to make this time of year festive for loved ones with memory decline. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So how can caregivers manage their own stress and difficult emotions that they may be experiencing this time of year? Because it is very difficult.
It's such a great question. I mean, so thinking about this from the caregiver's perspective, A, they are super busy to begin with in their caregiving role. B, now there's a huge new task on top of all that, planning a, you know, a holiday celebration or conveying their loved one to a holiday celebration. And C, there's sort of what the holidays mean. You know, so the holidays can be a time of joy and the family getting together, but it can also be a time of some wistfulness and sadness for what you've lost. And one thing that a caregiver has lost is the person they once knew. I mean, that person is still there, of course, but is different and has changed. And so, you know, it's a really complicated set of emotions to deal with during that time. So I think some of the usual caregiving advice applies, you know, making sure to take care of yourself, have time for yourself in terms of exercise or some of the shopping or whatever the, you know, little joys are in life, having time with other folks, with friends and other family members, getting enough sleep. I mean, that's a huge issue. And that's tough for a caregiver because a person with dementia may be wandering at night, may be up going to the bathroom frequently, etc. So that's tough. But like getting a good night's rest, if at all possible during the holidays, would be really critical. And, you know, taking, you know, good care of yourself, including not eating too much, not drinking too much, and trying to maintain as much of that routine as possible during the holidays.
Let's shift for a moment to the science and what you're seeing new on the horizon as researchers try to get a handle on what's going on here with dementia and, you know, how we can go about looking for perhaps a cure or some more management of this memory loss. What do you see going on in the science?
Well, thank you for asking. And we've got great colleagues here at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and many centers across the country looking at this. So with respect to dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, we're trying to get a better understanding of early diagnosis, identifying people even before they have any symptoms of could they be at risk of developing dementia and then intervening at that stage. So, for example, there's a lot of interest in something called amyloid. It's a protein that builds up for all kinds of reasons in the brain. And one of those reasons is that the person may be going on to develop dementia. And so there are research studies underway looking at people in midlife, looking at their levels of amyloid and trying to figure out, can we predict who might go on to develop dementia and then intervene at that stage? And so there might be anti-amyloid therapies, but there could be other interventions as well. Exercise, dietary habits. There's a lot of interesting work on a version of the Mediterranean diet called the MIND diet. That's kind of Mediterranean plus a low-salt diet that may help prevent dementia. So looking at a lot of those kind of lifestyle factors, also addressing things like hearing loss, depression, smoking, those are all potential things that could contribute to dementia and are treatable conditions. So there's a lot of interest in prevention.
Yeah, and let alone that the brain is a very complicated place that we have very not yet, you know, mastered in really any way.
Exactly.
It's still a lot to figure out.
Yeah.
Well, really appreciate it, Dr. Walasek. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for covering this topic, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. Dr. Yeah. Art Walasek is a psychiatry professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's a member of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Just ahead, sometimes we find comfort in unexpected places, like having a conversation with a total stranger. Have you made eye contact or struck up a conversation with someone in an elevator or on a bus? How did that go? What caused you to open up to a stranger? Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.